A couple of months ago, we put a box in the auditorium foyer and asked if any had questions to put those in it, and if we could, we would address them. Last month, Carl addressed a couple of those, and in July, we're going to have another one addressed. And so this evening, I wanted to deal with two that we have recently received in the box. Both of these really are somewhat related, and I think that'll come out as we go through them. The first question stated this: I've noticed Christians talking about or celebrating the Sabbath on Sundays. Is the Lord's Day a biblical concept or tradition? Should we be celebrating the Lord's Day as a day of rest? Why is the Sabbath being celebrated on Sunday when it was historically on Saturdays? There's a lot to talk about with this that we'll not get to this evening. Of course, there are some major denominations today that would still practice the religious exercises that they do on Saturday, but I want to deal specifically with this question. And to begin with, we're going to back up and take kind of a running start at this with what the Bible tells us about the Sabbath day. The first time we have the Sabbath day actually coming about is the week of creation. So it's first mentioned at the very dawn of time. And you'll remember that as the Lord finishes His creation, it says on the seventh day, God finished His work that He had done, and He rested on the seventh day from all the work that He had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it God rested from all His work that He had done in creation. Now, this verse is going to make an appearance again in the Bible, as we'll see. But I want us to note here at the very beginning, as God records this, there's no implications for mankind. So in other words, God is not making any kind of proclamation that this is what you must do on this day. It's simply stated very matter of fact. And so as time passes, we come across the Sabbath day again. It's going to be very much in association with the nation of Israel. And so we see that as we continue on, as Israel is beginning to prepare to leave Egypt, and God is going to establish the Passover celebration, we're going to have a mention again of a special commemoration of this seventh day. So we're looking at Exodus chapter 12, beginning in verse 14. It says, "This day shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations as a statute forever. You shall keep it as a feast. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven out of your houses. For if anyone eats what is leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day you shall hold a holy assembly." And then we have the seventh day coming into view again. "And on the seventh day a holy assembly. No work shall be done on those days, but what everyone needs to eat, that alone may be prepared for you." Now, we don't have the Sabbath as it will come to be as of yet, but here we find it being one of the 2 days mentioned, first and seventh, that's going to be a day of commemoration and a day in which no work is to be done. When we continue on with the history of Israel, we find that the weekly observation of the Sabbath is going to begin when they're in the wilderness. Now, you'll recall that Israel began complaining that they didn't have enough to eat. So God says, "All right, I'm going to send food for you. A part of that food is going to be bread that falls from heaven." And He gives instructions on how to gather that bread. So we're looking at Exodus 16 now. And the Lord says, "On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, 'This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow,'" speaking of the Sabbath, the seventh day, "'tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, lay aside to be kept till morning.'" So here we begin to see what's going to be the normal way of life for Israel on the Sabbath day. Now, as we begin to look in the law of Moses, we're going to find the codification of the Sabbath day. In other words, God is now going to put it in concrete terms. This is a day that is to be kept by you as a holy day for me. We look in Exodus chapter 20. With the Ten Commandments, the Lord says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And He gives instructions here. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. Now we've got the reappearance of that verse we noticed earlier. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Now we know that Israel's going to have problems keeping this, that there will be times when God says you are ignoring the very heart of what I told you with the Sabbath. But here is the flat out language where He says, this is a day that you are to keep, you are to honor me. So why does God tell Israel in particular to do this? Well, we could answer that question by saying, well, God says He made heaven and earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day He rested, and He made that day holy. But there's going to be a unique tie specifically with the nation of Israel. And as Moses is giving his final speeches to Israel, he gives us that reason. We're looking over to the book of Deuteronomy. And as we look in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15, Moses says, just as was stated in the Ten Commandments, observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. Then we've got the repetition. You don't work, your sons don't work, your daughters, your slaves, your animals, foreigners, nobody works. But let's look down a little bit further. If you look at the underlined section, Moses says, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So here we learn that as God tells Israel to keep the Sabbath, that this is to be a day not only of rest, not only in remembrance of what happened at creation, but an acknowledgement that God, through a mighty hand, brought them out of the land of slavery. So in other words, on this day of rest, they can recall what God has done for them, that God was with them and that God delivered them. Though they were slaves, they are slaves no more. Though they had to work every day, not anymore. This is what they were to remember. And He says, this is to be something that you do as a nation from here on out. This is something that you are to remember throughout your generations. Exodus 31, the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a covenant forever. We have to take those two phrases together. As long as they were God's chosen people, this was their covenant. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel. And here we go once again from that first week that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day He was rested and was refreshed. So what do we have then? As long as this nation existed as the people of God, they are to remember the Sabbath. They are to remember it was the day God rested. They are to remember it as a day when God brought them out of the land of Egypt. And by the way, this is the exact same language we have with other holy days. Leviticus 23 is going to say very similar things about the Feast of Weeks. You are to keep it forever, as long as your generations last. So, here we have what God told the children of Israel. Now, is this going to change? Are we to still observe the Sabbath today? Are we messing up by meeting today rather than having met yesterday? Well, there would be some who would say, yes, you surely are messing up. But let's think about this for a minute. Everything that was dealing with the responsibilities of the Sabbath, A, was for Israel, and B, was before the time of Christ. How do we know that? Well, as Jesus comes, there were those who were accusing him of breaking the law, of just disregarding it. And so he says, look, I didn't come to destroy the law. I didn't come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So that means when Jesus died on the cross, everything that the law of Moses had been looking toward is finished. It had done its work. And so it's as if we come to the end of that book and Christ says, I now am the fulfillment of everything that it's been talking about. He said, I didn't come to destroy it. I'm the reason the law was given. It was pointing toward me. And thus we find that with his coming and his sacrificial death on the cross, the law was completed. And from that time forward, whether you were Jew or Gentile, you were to follow the teachings of Christ. Now, some would say at this point that really what happens is Christ completes the ceremonial law, but not the moral law. So you get rid of the ceremony in the law of Moses, but you keep the rest of it. I challenge you to find anywhere where that distinction is made, where Christ says, I came to fulfill this part, but not that part. So then what that means is the law, with all of its observations of the Sabbath, was fulfilled. And thus the question is, do we now find anything in the New Testament that would tell us to continue following that law? Well, let's go to the second part of this question that talks about the Lord's Day. Traditionally, we have called Sunday the Lord's Day. When you begin looking in the New Testament, that term is used one time. Now, let me make this distinction. You could say, well, it's used more than that because sometimes you read about the day of the Lord, which really would be the same thing as saying the Lord's day. And while grammatically that is correct, when you talk about the day of the Lord, it has a very different connotation. That's always a day of judgment, of God bringing judgment on people. The idea of a day simply being called the Lord's Day is found only in the book of Revelation. When John writes, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. Nowhere is that connected to Sunday. Now, traditionally, we've called it that, and my understanding is that you can go back to some very ancient documents, maybe even as early as the second century, and you find Christians referring to Sunday as the Lord's Day. But to find that hard and fast in the New Testament, you're not going to. What we find instead is the first day of the week. And there's going to be two occasions where we find Christians meeting what appears to be very matter-of-factly on Sunday, on the first day of the week. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, it says, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread. Now you drop that in its context, and here is Paul and his company. They've been waiting. They're meeting with the saints. They've waited around until the first day of the week because they know that's a day they're going to come together. Second time we find, as Paul writes to the Corinthians, when he says, on the first day of the week, each of you put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. So in other words, Paul's saying, I don't want to have to come knock on everybody's door and say, pay it up. You're going to be together on the first day of the week. Bring your collection that day. What we do not find is any kind of obligation for Christians to meet on the Sabbath day. Now, is there any mention of the Sabbath in the New Testament? Absolutely. Does the Apostle Paul preach on the Sabbath day? Yes, he does. Why? Because there were a large number of Jews assembled who needed to hear the gospel of Christ. But we do not find Christians in the first century observing the Sabbath day as a holy day of rest as they did under the law of Moses. Here we find that they're meeting together on the first day of the week. Never do we find Sunday, the first day of the week, called the Sabbath. Now that's something that we'll hear occasionally now. We'll hear somebody talking about the Christian Sabbath. Or maybe you even hear somebody who's wishing someone else a good Sabbath day on Sunday. And the explanation for that is, well, the Sabbath day for Christians is Sunday, therefore Sunday is the Christian Sabbath. That is making a connection that cannot be made in the New Testament. Never do we find the first day ever called the Sabbath, and never do we find regulations placed on Sunday as it was with the Sabbath day. There are still groups today who would say that if you work on Sunday, that you're sinning. That if you go out and you mow your yard or you go and you work in the afternoons or whatever, that you're violating the Christian Sabbath day. Again, no New Testament application there. We don't find that at all. And so to make those kinds of restrictions would mean that we are putting something there that does not belong. So let me end this part of our discussion with this question. Is there a Christian Sabbath? There most absolutely is. If you go to the book of Hebrews, the writer says, "For he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all of his works." We've read that quoted several times. Again in this passage he said, "They shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience," again he appoints a certain day, today. As through David so long afterwards, and the words already quoted, "Today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience." When is our Sabbath rest? Well, it's heaven. And so it's interesting that the Sabbath does what many of the things that were laid out in creation do. They have their fulfillment when we get to the end. The return to paradise, the return to the relationship with God, and this perpetual, continuing, eternal rest that God has promised. So then, are we wrong for meeting on Sundays? No. That's what's authorized by the example of the New Testament church. Should we be observing this day as they did the Sabbath? No. It's a completely different day. Not the same rules and regulations. Yet, we can still look forward to that rest. Let's look at our second question. Again, somewhat of a commonality here with the law of Moses. This question says the New Testament doesn't command that individuals give a certain amount, but mainstream Christianity expects tithes. Does anyone else feel guilty if you don't give at least 10%? Do you think that's still a pattern for what God wants or more because the poor woman's shekels were 100%? I understand a godly heart is most important, but when you're making a budget, what do you do? Good question. And it deals with, again, a whole lot of ideas. But let's go back and build our case. Quick journey. This time we're going to go a little earlier than the law of Moses. We're going to look at some pre-Mosaic tithing that took place. You'll recall that when Abraham had gone and he had helped rescue Lot and the others who had been taken captive, it says that Melchizedek comes out and blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Second time we find tithing taking place before the law of Moses was with Jacob. When Jacob was on his way to, on his way running away from a dangerous situation at home, God appears to him, gives him this vision that he's going to be with him. After that, Jacob made a vow saying, "If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you." So we're getting a picture of tithing, right? Tithing, meaning 10%. Here we find Abram doing it. Here we find Jacob doing it as well. Now, when we come to Moses, there is a lot said in the law of Moses about tithing. And so I'm going to limit our discussion tonight to just one passage, which I think will give us a pretty good picture of what tithing was all about. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, here's what Moses says. "You shall tithe all the yield of your seed that comes from the field year by year, and before the Lord your God in the place that He will choose to make His name dwell there, you shall eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and flock, that you may learn and fear the Lord your God always. And if the way is too long for you, so that you are not able to carry the tithe, when the Lord your God blesses you, because this place is too far from you, which the Lord your God chooses to set His name there, then you shall turn it into money and bind up the money in your hand and go to the place that the Lord your God chooses and spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household, and you shall not neglect the Levite who is within your towns, for he has no portion or inheritance with you." I am about to give you a gross oversimplification. So since I'm telling you that, don't fuss at me afterwards here. When we look at this passage, what are three things that it has in common? The tithe included all of their wealth. Everything that they had was to be in the purview here. Fields and flocks and lands and whatever it is. It involved also giving to the Levites. Why? The Lord says they don't have an inheritance. I didn't give them a land, so you make sure you're taking care of them. And He says you take this, or the money version of it, to the place that God chooses, which would be Jerusalem. So if you live too far away and you can't lead your flocks and such there, convert it to money, take it, and then give as the Lord commands. Let me make a second point. Tithing was not the only thing expected of Israel. When we look at Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 10, that's one place where we read of free will offerings. So in other words, here was above and beyond. And some of you are studying Proverbs now, so I thought I would include this. I love this particular proverb in 19:17, where it says, "Those who are generous to the poor lend to the Lord." The Lord is saying, okay, if you're kind to the poor, then you're doing that in my name. You're taking care of others in my name. That would again be something above and beyond. All right, so tithing, give 10%. Take that into consideration with everything you have. Remember the Levites. Remember where the Lord has chosen to place His name, that being in Jerusalem. That sounds like a very Jewish situation, doesn't it? Let's remember that. Now, let me address a second part of the question here that dealt with the poor widow. We got to remember, she lives under the Mosaic law, doesn't she? So all these things we've read in Leviticus and Deuteronomy would apply to her. And so the Lord's there at the temple, and the disciples are there, and they're watching people giving. It says, Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box, and He saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. And He said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for they all contributed out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." This is really not a discussion about tithing, though that would have been expected of her. This is much more of what God always wanted of His people. Did He want anybody who said, okay, I'm going to figure out to the exact percent, 10%, and that is it. That is all I'm putting in, nothing else. So here is the Lord saying, this is a kind of attitude God's always desired of His people. Here's a woman who is so given to the work of God that she's saying, I'm going to do everything I can, even to the point of putting myself in want, putting myself in need, so that the work of the Lord can continue. That was a Jew. That was a woman who lived under that law of tithing. All right. I'm not going to go back over this point since we just made it, but just by way of reminder, tithing would have ended when Christ fulfilled the law, right? Very Jewish situation. Give to the Levites. Give in Jerusalem. Take everything into consideration here. Everything written to them, that was finished. And so again, our question is, when we open the pages of the New Testament, do we find any particular command to keep on tithing, to keep on giving 10%? Well, how much should a Christian give? Well, the answer to my question, first question is, we don't find any obligatory verse that says, now in the days of Christ, give 10% of everything. This is how you're to do it. This is where you're to take it. We don't find that. And just to be very honest, we don't have a great deal told to us about giving in any way. As far as a specific command kind of thing, most of where we look to our authority comes from the words given to the Corinthians. And as far as generosity is concerned, you look to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. And so here's what Paul says. He says, the point is this. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And look at what he says here. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart. But we're not quite done. Not reluctantly or under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all time, you may abound in every good work. As it is written, He has distributed freely to the poor. He's given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God, for the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. By their approval of this service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ and the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others. It was talking about giving to a specific need, yet Paul gives a very general view of giving. Don't be stingy. Don't be reluctant. Don't do it because you feel like you got to rather than you want to. But do it in honor of God. Because of the generosity that He has shown to you, you show that generosity to others. So then, what we're finding in this is the idea of not tithing, but that we are making the decision of how much to give. Now, that's not altogether different than the Israelites, is it? Yes, they had the specific command for a tithe, but then they could also give free will. Here, though, Paul is indicating to us it is totally in your court how much you choose to give. Now, let's get back to our question. So, pertaining to the specific question, there is expressed in that a feeling of guilt if 10% is not given. To that, I would say, then by all means give 10%. If this is something that's producing a feeling of guilt, if you're falling under that amount, give 10% or give more than that. But don't have a feeling of guilt because of it. Just understand that 10% is not something that we find ensconced in New Testament command. Well, let me add this. What God has said of us is that He wants very much a spirit of generosity. He wants us to be the kind of people who are willing to give. So what then when we do prepare a budget? And I think that's very important for us to do because you and I well know that money has wings, doesn't it? And by the end of the month, it's oftentimes gone. So we do need to plan. We do need to prepare. And I would suggest let's budget the maximum. Let's look at what we're doing And rather than saying, well, I'm going to make sure I give 10%, look and say, what is the absolute maximum I can give on a very regular basis? Out of the money that I'm getting monthly when I take into consideration everything. But then I want to make a second suggestion. We then look for opportunities to give sacrificially. We can budget, but like any budget, that's not always going to be the case, is it? You might budget $200 for expenses each month, but there might be a month when your refrigerator goes out. There are things that happen. Well, there's things that happen concerning giving as well. And so if I'm budgeting, I'm looking at my monthly income and saying, okay, this is how much I can afford to give to the Lord each week, each month. This is what I'm going to do. But when those opportunities arise for me to give in other occasions, I'm not going to say, well, I'm giving all I can. I can't do anymore. I'm going to exercise that spirit of generosity that says, well, if I have to give up something, I'll give up something. If there's something I was planning on doing that was going to be great fun, or there's something I was going to purchase that was needed for my house, I'm going to put that off. Because here's something that I can do in the work of the Lord. Now, to have that attitude, we got to look beyond the collection plate. If everything we're doing is motivated by what we're putting into the plate on Sunday morning, we're missing a lot of opportunities to give in the service of the Lord. And so I would remind us of what the apostle wrote as he was teaching Timothy what to go out and preach. He said, now when you're talking to those who are rich in this world's goods, teach them this: they are to do good and to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. So here then, I think we find an answer to our question. Do I just give 10%? Am I wrong if I give under 10%? That's probably the wrong way of looking at this. It's more of, if I am a generous giver and I appreciate what God has done, how much can I give? Not how little. How much can I give? And when those opportunities come along, I'm going to be the first in line, so to speak, to say, all right, even if this is going to cost me something, if I'm going to have to sacrifice something, that is exactly what I'm going to do. I hope that's helpful. I hope whoever put these questions in is here tonight and that was helpful, but I hope it's been helpful to all of us to consider these things that are very important to us. Again, topics that we find amongst our religious friends that have a fair amount of misunderstanding. Hopefully that'll help us to be able to answer when those questions come up.